Today is Friday, November 13th, and this is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, progress toward the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines around the world.
This is no doubt that a vaccine will be a vital tool for controlling the pandemic.
Also ahead, the aftermath of Typhoon Vamco in the Philippines.
Tens of thousands of homes were submerged as a storm caused some of the worst flooding in years in the capital, Manila.
Plus, how Indigenous Australians are trying to save their dying languages. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is COVID-19. The global COVAX facility said Friday that it has exceeded its initial goal of raising more than $2 billion to distribute future COVID-19 vaccines to poorer countries. The COVAX facility was set up by the World Health Organization and the Gavi Vaccine Group earlier this year. The group said Friday that the funds will allow COVAX to buy 1 billion doses of vaccine for 92 eligible countries, which otherwise would not be able to afford them. COVAX said it passed the $2 billion U.S. dollar funding mark after receiving an additional $360 million in recent weeks. Those donations came from the European Commission, France, Spain, South Korea, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and others. But Gavi said it still needs an additional $5 billion in 2021 to ensure vaccine doses reach around the world. This funding news comes after U.S. drug maker Pfizer and German partner BioNTech SE said Monday that a vaccine they are developing was 90% effective against COVID-19. That data was based on initial results from a large late-stage trial. The results need to be confirmed by safety data. Still, WHO Director Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warned Friday that although there is promising news on the vaccine front, countries should not rely solely on a vaccine to fight the pandemic.
This is no doubt that a vaccine will be a vital tool for controlling the pandemic. And we're encouraged by the preliminary results of clinical trials released this week. Never in history has the vaccine research progressed so quickly. We must apply the same urgency and innovation to ensuring that all countries benefit from this scientific achievement. But we have a long way to go. The world cannot put all its eggs in one basket and neglect the many other tools at our disposal.
That was WHO Director Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. So how will these developments toward a vaccine impact Africa's fight against COVID-19? To find out, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dr. Jesse Goodman, a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Dr. Goodman is a former chief scientist at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which is the federal agency responsible for approving vaccines and other drugs in the U.S. Here's a clip of their conversation.
Tell us about the challenges that you contemplate for the West and Africa once a safe coronavirus vaccine is available.
Certainly, distribution of vaccines to large numbers of people, being sure that can be safely done. Tracking the doses. In many cases, you may need to track for a second dose. Most of these early vaccines are two-dose vaccines. So there's a huge logistic challenge for any country, and then for countries without as much healthcare infrastructure or funding, it could be really significant.
Can you give me a specific problem that will have to be addressed when distributing this vaccine? I'm thinking especially of remote and rural places.
Sure. Most vaccines already need to be protected when they're stored and transported by being in the cold. That might be normal freezing or refrigeration. But for example, the earliest vaccines out, or at least the current one that gotten all the attention in the last week of Pfizer's, have to be transported at what we call ultra-low temperatures. And that uses freezers that aren't generally accessible, even in the U.S.
What happens if those double-dose vaccines get too warm?
They can lose their potency and they wouldn't be effective. But there are many other vaccines being studied, something like 200 candidates globally, and several of them will probably only require one dose. So those will be much easier vaccines to use logistically.
Of course, there's also psychology at play here. Some folks here in the U.S. and in Africa simply don't trust vaccines of any kind.
Yeah, and we've seen that generated or exploited politically in the past. And there's a lot of mistrust of the pharmaceutical industry. Added to that, there is the global perception that because these are new vaccines and have been sped up in their research and development process, that they might not be safe. And so I think the communication about what is known about these vaccines is going to be really important, because you could have the best vaccine in the world, but if people don't trust it and don't trust the person or system administrating it, we're not going to be able to use them to help end the pandemic. And I would say one other issue for countries that are challenged in terms of their resources is, how much of a problem do they see COVID, and how does it compare to some of their other challenges? We see COVID in the scientific community as a highly contagious disease that could be quite severe and fatal, particularly for individuals with underlying conditions or older individuals. But some countries may be comparing that to potential resource use, for example, to measles, where the world is falling behind because of this COVID outbreak. So it's also going to be that countries are going to have to make decisions about where this fits in their priorities.
How does the COVID pandemic and its challenges compare to the Ebola outbreak of several years ago?
Very different diseases. Ebola, you know, requiring very close contact generally, but relatively easy to control, although obviously, it took Herculean efforts, but public health measures could be quite effective there. Even though the disease is more severe and terrifying, which certainly motivated people living in those countries to be interested in the vaccine. But on the other hand, coronavirus, much more common, much more contagious. I think we're going to learn a lot from it. It's still not clear where the money comes from. People have to raise the money every time there's a crisis. You know, this is true of global health in general. There really should be some kind of global health budget that when there's an emergency can be drawn from. We need to be better prepared the next time, because this isn't going to be the last pandemic.
That was Dr. Jesse Goodman, a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., speaking to my VOA colleague, Adam Phillips. Confirmed global COVID-19 infections have passed 52 million, with nearly 1.3 million deaths, the WHO says. One of the worst COVID-19 outbreaks is in the United States, where cases soared to new highs this week and hospitalizations and deaths increased. On Thursday, there were over 153,000 new cases in the U.S. That's the first time U.S. daily infections crossed the 150,000 mark, according to Johns Hopkins University. This surge in cases comes 2 weeks ahead of the national Thanksgiving holiday, in which American families often gather in large groups. AP's Sagar Meghani reports that some officials are urging families to avoid such celebrations.
In Chicago, where the new daily case total has nearly quadrupled over the past month, Mayor Lori Lightfoot is urging residents to only go out for essentials, and starting Monday will limit social gatherings to 10 people.
You must cancel the normal Thanksgiving plans.
Detroit will suspend in-person classes next month. In Louisiana, a judge has rejected a GOP effort to end Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards' statewide mask mandate and other restrictions. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Despite the COVID-19 surge, U.S. President Donald Trump has largely failed to mention the coronavirus pandemic recently. Following his projected defeat by President-elect Joe Biden, Trump has remained silent, except for posting largely debunked electoral fraud claims on Twitter. For months, while he focused on political campaigning, Trump did not attend meetings of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Vice President Mike Pence led the group's meeting on Monday for the first time in nearly 3 weeks. The White House is rejecting criticism from the Democrats that Trump, stung by election defeat, has prematurely ceased governing. Meanwhile, President-elect Biden's incoming White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klain, says Biden will appoint a COVID coordinator who will lead the administration's pandemic response. Klain, speaking on the MSNBC network Thursday night, says the coordinator will have direct access to the president and will brief him daily on the pandemic, the AP reports. The coordinator will also have a team of people to arrange vaccine distribution, address supply chain disruptions, and improve access to testing. Klain served in a similar role in 2014 under President Barack Obama when he was the administration's Ebola response coordinator. The Voice of America has called the southwestern U.S. state of Arizona for President-elect Joe Biden. Arizona's 11 electoral votes bring Biden's total projected electoral votes from 279 to 290. Only 270 are needed for a victory. President Trump so far has won 217 electoral votes. VOA has not projected a winner for two remaining states, Georgia and North Carolina, both of which are located in the southeastern part of the country. As Biden prepares for the presidency, he has been taking calls from various world leaders. On Thursday, Washington time, he spoke for the first time since the election with the leaders of Japan, South Korea, and Australia, who reaffirmed their commitment to tackling climate change and regional security. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
Key U.S. allies in Asia made their first phone calls to President-elect Joe Biden on Thursday, reaffirming U.S. military commitments in the region and pledging to work together on the global health crisis and climate change. It meant the leaders of South Korea, Japan, and Australia joined others in recognizing Biden's victory over President Donald Trump, who has refused to concede. Biden's projected win comes as China increasingly asserts its military and economic dominance in the region. Chinese President Xi Jinping has stayed silent on Biden's election so far. On South Korean President Moon Jae-in's Biden call, Moon's spokesperson said Biden had reaffirmed the American commitment to defend South Korea.
President Moon asked President-elect Biden to closely communicate on denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and the establishment of lasting peace. Biden said that South Korea is the linchpin of security and prosperity in the Indo-Pacific region.
South Korean officials are also hopeful that Biden will quickly resolve a drawn-out multi-billion-dollar dispute with Washington over the cost of thousands of U.S. troops on the peninsula. Both Moon and Japanese leader Yoshihide Suga have agreed to arrange summits with Biden after his inauguration in January, while Australia's Scott Morrison invited the president-elect to celebrate the 70th anniversary of their security treaty sometime next year.
Thanks to Gloria So of Reuters for that report. Also in Asia, China on Friday broke its silence over the U.S. election by sending a congratulatory message to President-elect Joe Biden. AP's Mike Hempen reports.
A country mired in a tariff war with the Trump administration has reacted to the results of the U.S. presidential election. China has become one of the last major governments to congratulate Joe Biden on being elected U.S. president. A foreign ministry spokesman said, quote, "We respect the choice of the American people. We congratulate Mr. Biden." China, along with Russia, avoided joining the many governments that congratulated Biden last weekend after he was projected to have secured enough electoral college votes to win the White House. The foreign ministry spokesman gave no reason for the delay. I'm Mike Hempen.
This is VOA. A civil courts trial has begun in Japan over Nissan's demands for 10 billion yen, or $95 million, in damages from its former chairman, Carlos Ghosn, the AP reports. The automaker sued Ghosn over what it says is harm suffered from various types of alleged financial misconduct. Ghosn jumped bail late last year while awaiting a separate criminal trial in Japan. He said in a statement Friday from Lebanon that the latest trial will prove his innocence. Nissan said it was confident its allegations of Ghosn's misconduct will become clear in the trial.
This is Science in a Minute.
On May
22nd, NASA's Neil Gehrels Swift Observatory detected a quick but powerful burst of gamma rays. Scientists, led by Northwestern University, say the bright burst released more energy in just a half a second than our sun has and will throughout its 10 billion year lifespan. They observed the burst's afterglow in optical, X-ray, near-infrared, and radio wavelengths with several ground-based telescopes and the Hubble Space Telescope. After analyzing observational data, the team found that they may have witnessed the birth of a magnetar, a fast-rotating neutron star with a powerful magnetic field. The team says they believe this magnetar was produced by the merger of two neutron stars in a galaxy some 5.4 billion light-years away. They say when two neutron stars merge, a black hole, not a magnetar, is usually produced. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Police and soldiers in the Philippines searched for dozens of people still missing on Friday after Typhoon Vamco killed at least 39 people and caused some of the worst flooding in years in the capital Manila and nearby provinces. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
Residents living in a Manila suburb returned to their homes on Friday to start the cleanup from Typhoon Vamco. They found streets caked in mud, their houses full of floodwater, and with no electricity. At least 39 people were killed when Typhoon Vamco tore through the main island of Luzon late on Wednesday. Tens of thousands of homes were submerged as the storm caused some of the worst flooding in years in the capital, Manila. Police and soldiers were searching for dozens of people still missing on Friday. Vamco is the eighth typhoon to hit the Philippines in 2 months and adds to the strain on a government already grappling with coronavirus and a recession. Virtual classes and government work has been suspended in Luzon. On Friday, the typhoon was headed for central Vietnam, which is already reeling from devastating floods and mudslides. At least 160 people have been killed there since early October.
Thanks to Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters for that report. The World Health Organization reports measles cases and deaths have soared around the globe since 2016. It reports an increase in cases to nearly 870,000 last year, while more than 207,000 people died, a 50% increase from 2016 levels. As Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, many of those becoming sick are children.
The World Health Organization reports a steady and steep decline in the number of children getting immunizations against this killer disease. The UN agency says the failure to inoculate children on time with two doses of measles vaccines is the main driver for increased cases and deaths. It says vaccination coverage remains well below the 95% needed to control the disease and prevent outbreaks and deaths. Added to this mix is the coronavirus pandemic. Although reported cases of measles are lower this year than last, WHO says efforts to control the coronavirus outbreak have resulted in disruptions in vaccination. WHO senior technical advisor for measles and rubella, Natasha Crowcroft, tells VOA different strategies are needed to prevent new measles outbreaks in the time of COVID-19, the disease brought on by the coronavirus.
The number one action we need to take is to prevent outbreaks from happening in countries where we've got the highest risk. And there are several where there isn't the ability for the health system in place to be able to rely on.
Crowcroft says countries where routine immunization for children was happening will recover quickly from delays or suspended coverage during this difficult period. She says weak countries will continue to be at risk of deadly outbreaks unless swift action is taken to close this widening gap. The WHO reports more than 94 million people are at risk of missing vaccines because nationwide campaigns have been put on pause in 26 countries. This led to huge outbreaks in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Madagascar. 8 of the 26 countries now have resumed their campaigns. They include Brazil, Central African Republic, Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Nepal, Nigeria, Philippines, and Somalia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new project is celebrating the linguistic culture of Australia's Aboriginal communities. The 50 Words Project aims to introduce Australians to everyday words and phrases from hundreds of Indigenous languages. Some of those languages are spoken by just a handful of people, while others have been revitalized by communities and academics. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The word for welcome varies across Australia's Indigenous language landscape. Hello comes in many different forms as well.
Kai.
Yeah.
So does where are you going?
Want
The 50 Words Project is an interactive online language map. Words and phrases from across this vast continent are brought to life with recordings from Indigenous speakers. It's run by the University of Melbourne's Research Unit for Indigenous Language and aims to maintain linguistic and cultural heritage. Jill Vaughan from the academic unit says she hopes it will help more Australians understand rich linguistic traditions.
It's unfortunately quite a common misconception that there's only one Indigenous Australian language, when in fact there are hundreds of languages, each with thousands and thousands of words. It's also the case that for some Australians, they assume that Indigenous languages are just a relic of the past, and this isn't the case at all.
Researchers say the sounds used in Australia's Indigenous languages are very similar across the country. Neighbouring communities, however, can have very different words for the same things. Some Indigenous languages in Australia have faded away since European colonisation, while others are considered to be critically endangered. Until the 1970s, government policies banned and discouraged Aboriginal people from speaking their mother tongues. Indigenous communities consider languages to be living things that connect people to their land, culture, and the spirits of their ancestors. Aboriginal history in Australia dates back up to 65,000 years. Indigenous people make up about 3% of the national population of 25 million. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
That's it for our show today. Thank you for listening. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I'm Jason Patingan in Washington. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to bringing to justice individuals around the world who are guilty of mass atrocities. One program established to help accomplish this goal is the War Crimes Rewards Program. It offers rewards of up to $5 million for information that leads to the arrest, transfer, or conviction of certain individuals wanted for war crimes, genocide, or crimes against humanity by international, hybrid, or mixed tribunals. The program is run by the U.S. State Department's Office of Global Criminal Justice, which is headed by Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice, Morse Tan. In an interview, Ambassador Tan said that currently the War Crimes Rewards Program, or WCRP, is focused on the six individuals still at large and wanted by the International Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals for their roles in the genocide that killed at least 800,000 men, women, and children in Rwanda in 1994. In May 2020, as Ambassador Tan noted, one of those designated war criminals listed by the WCRP was caught.
Felician Kabuga, who was the chief financier and arguably one of the biggest inciters of the Rwandan genocide, was apprehended in a suburb outside of Paris. It had been over 26 years that he was at large, and he was at the top of our list in terms of those who were on this, named in this War Crimes Rewards Program. So it was a major step that he was apprehended.
The remaining six Rwandans still on the war crimes rewards program list and wanted by the International Mechanism for their roles in the genocide are Proteus Impiranya, Fulgence Kayishima, Alois Ndimbati, Phineas Bunyarugarama, Charles Sikababwo, and Ryan Dekayo. Anyone who has information on these individuals can confidentially contact the program by emailing wcrp@state.gov or sending a WhatsApp or text message to +1 202 975 5468. Ambassador Tan said it is crucial that there be no impunity for the atrocities committed by such people.
And that's for its own sake, to satisfy justice. But it also has a preventative role in terms of prevention of these sorts of mass crimes.
Accountability, Ambassador Tan declared, is the single best way to prevent such gross injustices from happening again in the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.